From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Former Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman dies at age 82, leaving a legacy with lessons for today's politics. His death also raises questions about the future of the No Labels Third Party movement in 2024, where Joe Lieberman was a leader in trying to find an alternative to Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And what about Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s choice of a running mate this week? Does Nicole Shanahan help his candidacy or hurt one of the other two candidates? Plus, Friday marks Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich's year in captivity in Russia on false charges of espionage. Why is Vladimir Putin refusing to let him go? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal opinion page. I'm here with my colleagues Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn in our daily Potomac Watch podcast. Let's start with Joe Lieberman, who died Wednesday after a fall, a senator for 24 years, the first Jewish candidate on a major party national ticket as Al Gore's running mate in 2000, came within a whisker of becoming vice president in that race. As a personal remembrance, I first met him in 1988 when he was running against Lowell Weicker, a liberal Republican in Connecticut for the Senate. He was challenging the incumbent Weicker. I attended a debate between the two, and he was by far, Lieberman was the better candidate. And I more or less wrote that Lieberman won in an upset. A hell of a good guy. Wrote for our pages often, made a substantial mark on foreign policy in particular with his stalwart views about an assertive American role in the world and clear-eyed view about our enemies. Bill, you have any thoughts on Lieberman?
Yeah, his passing, we've really lost a lot. When I was in the Bush administration, his support for the Iraq War, despite his criticisms of how we prosecuted it, he was not just a blank check kind of guy, but his support for the war while Bush campaigned was very important, one of the only Democrats who was willing to do so. I think his death really marked something large in the Democratic Party. Liberal Americans, he was pretty liberal. Look at his overall voting record, some apostasies, but mostly a liberal, progressive Democrat. But he was old-fashioned. He believed if America's in a war, we should win it. And he wasn't shy about saying that. And he was not uncomfortable with the use of American force overseas. And I think in particular, look at liberal Jewish Americans. You know, in the past, they were at home in the Democratic Party and they could be strong supporters of Israel,
right,
and still be liberals. And today, if you want to know the changes, just look at Joe Lieberman and Chuck Schumer, who is criticizing Benjamin Netanyahu when he's fighting this existential war over there. So I think it's a real mark. It actually began with Lieberman. You know, Paul, when Lieberman was dumped by the Democratic Party, then he ran as an independent. He still caucused with the Democrats, but that was the first sign of kind of the party displeasure at him for going off the reservation. And not on principles, just on America and the moral use of force.
Well, I saw that tendency in those views on Lieberman, even in that campaign in 1988. Remember, Lowell Weicker was a thorn in the side of Ronald Reagan. He posed much of the Reagan foreign policy, as hugely successful as it turned out to be. When Weicker opposed various weapons systems, he posed SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative. And Lieberman's view was, actually, no, I support those things. And in particular, he had a strong view that an American president should have a lot of leeway on foreign policy. And he supported that view regardless of which party the president belonged to when he was in the White House. So, for example, he was one of, I think, the 10 Democratic senators who supported George H.W. Bush in the first Gulf War, Kim. And then, as Bill said, he was a supporter of Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as a forthright policy against Iran. But he also supported Bill Clinton in the 90s with Serbia and the Balkans.
Yeah, and this really hurt him at times. You talked about in 2006, he actually lost in a Democratic primary because of the backlash among the base to him and these positions. He went on to win a kind of stunning upset as an independent and beat Ned Lamont, who had become the Democratic primary holder. I would just like to point out and add my thoughts and prayers to his family, et cetera, and say kind of what a tragedy this is. I actually met Joe Lieberman in the early 2000s, he was always so gracious and kind. But, you know, I saw him just a couple of years ago. He was still in great shape and he was writing for us. He was working. So this is kind of sad. It sounds like an accident, a fall. But, you know, I always like to think of Joe Lieberman as sort of one of the last great independent Democrats in the Senate. We haven't had that in a while. And we've now been going through his views on foreign policy, which were very notable. And, you know, it led him, for instance, in 2008 to endorse John McCain for the presidency. He took a lot of flack for that as well, too. I always thought that his support for the war in some ways was harder than those in the Republican side who were pushing back against those who wanted to run for the exits in Iraq, just because it was so much less popular in the Democratic Party and he stood tall. But the other thing I always remember about him, too, is that while he was very much in line with the general Democratic belief of bigger government and government there to provide things for the people, he understood that that did not work unless you had a strong economy. And he was an independent thinker on that, too. So he, you know, was a Democrat who supported lower tax rates on capital gains. When the big debate came up on Obamacare, yes, he did vote for it in the end, but he was very instrumental to stripping the public option out of it because he understood the risks that would pose to private insurance and the private healthcare market. So that has kind of gone by the wayside a bit as we've become more of a progressive Democratic Party all in all. But his voice was very important in many of those key domestic debates, too.
Absolutely correct. He wrote for us, including his last piece, I think he wrote anywhere, was for us taking on Chuck Schumer for his recent speech. The Democratic Senate leader who criticized Israel's government and actually called for the Israeli people to have an election and overturn their government. Lieberman wrote a forceful piece for us just a couple weeks ago criticizing Schumer. But he was also active lately in the No Labels movement. And let's listen to him talk about why he was supporting that third party effort.
This whole movement and No Labels to run a third choice bipartisan unity ticket started because our members saw another Trump-Biden race coming and thought the country could do better. And every poll that's taken shows that most of the people in our country think that we can do better than those two choices, and they want something other than Trump and Biden. But, you know, the primaries were going on. Anything can happen. But they're over. They're basically over now. And it is Trump and Biden. Which means more slash and burn, nastiness, division, partisanship. And whichever one of them gets elected, unfortunately, not much is going to change in Washington.
So I think personally that's right. Not much is going to change. Still be bitter and ugly politics no matter which of the main candidates win. But No Labels looks like it's having a very hard time, Bill, finding that candidate to run. A lot of prominent people have taken themselves out of the running. Joe Manchin, Nikki Haley, Chris Christie this week saying he thought the American people need to have this conversation about a third party, but anything that might help Donald Trump win, he would not support, and he didn't see a way to win. So where does No Label stand after Joe Lieberman's death?
Well, I personally thought it didn't stand too far up, even when Joe Lieberman was around. He was probably its best asset in that he was a serious politician, took serious stands, and people knew him and so forth. I think the third parties in general have lacked credible conservative or right-leaning alternatives. They have no problem finding more liberal Americans to run, but they have a problem finding people. And that's endemic to a party like that. Usually a party forms around a person like Kennedy, like Perot, and so forth, who's kind of new. And No Labels, like when they had the press conference, you know, it was Joe Lieberman, Huntsman, Joe Manchin, I think. They were all kind of has-beens. So I think this does hurt him because Joe Lieberman was a conviction guy. And when you form a party on the basis, the only basis is I'm not the other two candidates, and you're not running on any principle except for that, it's very hard, I think, when you have no agenda, really, that anyone agrees on. Because one of the things, even though the polls show people prefer a different choice, they might reject both of these men, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, for different reasons. And Joe Biden, it might be they don't like his record on the economy, spending, and now with Israel. and Trump for his personality and the court cases. So they might have different things that they object to.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the third party run, including RFK Jr. and where that race with his VP selection stands when we come back.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here on Potomac Watch with Kim Straussel and Bill McGurn. And you heard Bill McGurn talk about the fading hopes for No Labels as a third party. But there's still RFK Jr. out there. He's still ticking and pushing. This week, he made an appointment of his VP nominee, Nicole Shanahan, former wife of Google founder Sergey Brin, a donor to many liberal causes. Let's listen to her talk about RFK Jr.'s candidacy.
It is time for a realignment. It is time, as Bobby Kennedy says, to focus on our unifying values rather than our divisions. And so if anyone is listening who never considered an independent ticket, I want to extend the same invitation to you that my friend did to me last year. Please listen to Bobby Kennedy in his own words. Take a look at his vision for America. It is a vision that I share too, as I spend the next 7 months of my life getting him on each and every ballot in this country.
Interesting choice, I guess. Neophyte to partisan politics. Nicole Shanahan, on the other hand, very wealthy, will be able to help RFK Jr. get on more ballots, more state ballots, Kim. And RFK Jr. is about 13-15% in the polls right now, which is not insubstantial and could mean trouble for one or the other candidates. Does this help his campaign, this pick, or which candidate the others should be more worried about it?
I think it helps him in the short term. And she just laid out right there her value to him, which is this is a campaign that is getting some attention, but it is struggling for money. She has a lot of it. You know, she was the person that put several million into a super PAC that enabled that Super Bowl ad that caught everybody's attention on RFK. And she's going to put that money toward getting him on the ballot, which is the number one challenge that he faces at the moment, especially because Democrats are coming out in force to challenge him and thwart him legally in a bunch of these states. So that's going to matter. I think overall, though, her candidacy could hurt him. And this why she's very much in the liberal mold. And while RFK looks a bit like a gadfly at times on issues like vaccines, et cetera, and therefore has some appeal with some conservative voters, she helps to crystallize the fact that this is, in fact, a very progressive candidate because she herself comes across that way. It just clarifies a little bit where he falls on the spectrum. And it is no surprise that Donald Trump came out on Truth Social this week and said, you know, this guy is a super lefty. He's very, very liberal. I'm thrilled he's running because he wants to cast him in that mold so that he becomes more of a threat to peeling away voters to Joe Biden. And I think that's going to be something for everyone to watch closely. It's the Democratic playbook of trying to boost other campaigns. They've done it very successfully in Republican primaries to get candidates that are further right that they think will be more beatable in the general election. I think you're going to see Republicans do a version of this. So not only is RFK a threat just in that he is an alternative on the left to Joe Biden, but he could get boosted by Republicans to put him more firmly in some voters' minds.
Just to quote directly from Trump's post on Truth Social, he said, RFK Jr. is the most radical left candidate in the race by far. He's a big fan of the Green New Scam and other economy-killing disasters. I guess this would mean he's going to be taking votes from crooked Joe Biden, which would be a great service to America. I love that he is running from Donald Trump. I think the interesting point here is that if you look at the polling and look at RFK and his candidacy, Trump is really calculating, as Kim said, that RFK Jr. will take more votes from Biden, may or may not be true in the end. But I think it is becoming clear RFK Jr. has no chance to win the Electoral College. And I don't think he's going to win any state, but he could be a spoiler here. And that's why you see the Biden campaign as alarmed as it is.
Yeah, I think the reactions of the two campaigns show you what's most likely. The Biden campaign is mobilizing to try to keep him off the ballot. I think he's only on the ballot in Utah so far. So if he wants to spoil the campaign, he has
got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, he has to be in the election. And he'll get some now, as Kim points out, has a vice presidential pick. And Trump is, and the RNC are defining him more accord with his liberal beliefs, which I think is actually fair to say, even though there are some things that look kind of conservative and so forth. I mean, they're even talking about maybe putting him on the libertarian ticket, which kind of astounds me that they would do that. I'm not sure they would go for him. So I think by the reaction of the campaigns, you kind of know where that threat is coming from. And remember, the spoilers don't have to spoil in every state, just some of the swing states, and they could be by a few votes. Look at what Jill Stein did to Hillary Clinton in 2016. So they don't have to be a force all over. They just have to prevail in a few tight states to make a difference in the election. And again, the last difference is the difference between no labels is Joe Lieberman said, if I think it's going to elect Donald Trump, I'll withdraw. I will not support it. And he made it clear he would vote for Joe Biden. And Bobby Kennedy, when he was asked, would he withdraw if he was a spoiler for one of the candidates, he said no.
Yeah, very big difference. Joe Lieberman said, we will not, at no labels, run a candidate who would be a spoiler, only if we have a chance to win. All right, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about our colleague, Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who marks his anniversary of captivity on Friday. Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with The Wall Street Journal with Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. And we just want to finish today, if our listeners don't mind, a point of editorial privilege here, talking about our colleague Evan Gershkovich. He's the 32-year-old reporter for The Wall Street Journal, had been reporting in Russia, Russian-speaking, reporting what he heard and saw in that country, and was arrested a year from Friday. And he's been languishing in Lefortovo prison in Moscow ever since. No formal charges, though there's the allegation that he somehow was committing espionage. The journal and the U.S. government have both vehemently denied that. There's been no formal charges yet. It's still in what Moscow court called investigative phase, but his detention was extended for another 3 months on Tuesday, at the request of the Russian security service, the FSB. Evan is the first American journalist taken since the end of the Cold War. He's held up very well by all accounts of people who've seen him, but it is a horrible predicament he is in, and he really is, Kim, at the mercy of one Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, it's absolutely dreadful. And I would stress what you just said about being the first journalist in that long, because it says something about the tactics that Putin is using and his escalation. Obviously, other Americans have been detained. We had Brittany Griner, we've had Paul Whelan is over there, so business people, etc. But taking a journalist is a new step. It's one that really should stand in its own category because of the knock-on effects when stuff like that happens. What ends up happening is other reporters then understand the risk. There are fewer people on the ground. There are fewer people to write about the atrocities. And there's a fear that goes around. That's the goal of Putin. It's not just that he now has this leverage and this hostage, as it were, but it's a way of further denying, as it were, any coverage of what's happening in that country. It's why it was such a dramatic and awful step and something that needs to be universally condemned, in addition and alongside the work to get Evan out and get him his freedom.
The Biden administration has been working to get him released, so far to no avail. And let's listen to Joe Biden.
Here in this chamber tonight, our families whose loved ones are still being held by Hamas, I pledge to all the families that we will not rest until we bring every one of your loved ones home. We also we will also work around the clock to bring home Evan and Paul, Americans being unjustly detained by the Russians.
That's Evan Gershkovich and Paul Whelan, a former Marine who has been in custody in Russia for 5 years now. Typically, Bill, these things now are settled with prisoner swaps. It's unfortunate that that's the case, but that's kind of where we are now geopolitically here. Russians and others, the Iranians, practice this kidnapping, hostage-taking as well in order to spring some of the people that are held for actually having committed crimes in the United States. But it doesn't look right now that Putin wants anyone that is in American custody now. The guy he really wants is an assassin by the name of Vadim Krasikov, who killed a Chechen insurgent leader in cold blood in a park in Germany with children watching in 2019. Now in prison in Germany, but understandably, Germany, given the nature of Krasikov's crime, doesn't want to let him out easily.
Yeah, I'm not going to criticize anyone involved in what the negotiations are, because it's a really tough place. We have an innocent man, two innocent men, as I understand, wrongfully detained by Putin just for cold-blooded reasons. He figures they'll be useful for him at some point. He's in no rush. There's no incentive for him to release these guys. So I think it's just important the president keeps their names out there. Paul, you lived abroad for many years. You know when you're abroad, you're very vulnerable. And if you're taken wrongfully, the only thing you have going for you is that your home country doesn't forget you and presses your case. So I was heartened that they were mentioned, the Hamas hostages, Paul Whelan and Evan, at the State of the Union. And I'll wait to see what comes by. But there's just little incentive for Putin. And there's another incentive. Say he makes a deal, frees these guys, and then takes more people when he needs them, when he wants something. And no one's quite figured out a good way around that.
Well, that's exactly right, Bill. That's the incentive that you see and negotiate for swaps. Now, we want desperately to get Evan back, so I'm not going to oppose any swap here. Certainly, any decision that the U.S. government makes in that regard, that's our main goal, getting him out. But I do think that Evan's arrest and predicament does show how much the world has changed from when I was traveling in the 1980s in some hotspot around the world, Afghanistan, Pakistan, along the Afghan border, and the Philippines and other places where there were revolutions and democratic protests and revolutions. But American power stood for a lot more there at that time. There was a lot more reluctance on the part of these governments to take Americans prisoners, especially journalists, Kim.
Yeah, I think that's sort of what I was trying to say is in terms of this and the escalation, which is undoubtedly brought on because folks like Putin or Xi or others don't necessarily fear anymore an American retribution or the repercussions of engaging in that, not just by taking journalists, but others. And, you know, when I sit and I think about the list of countries today that I would not go to unless directly ordered, and even then potentially not, just because of the risk of knowing that these guys actually now view the possibility of a journalist, especially anyone that has ever been critical of their regime, stepping on their grounds and drumming up and ginning up an excuse for arresting you, and you're entirely at their mercy. And then, as you said, we're also playing a kind of gentleman's game here, but one-sided in that we aren't necessarily grabbing their people to use for trades. You know, I mean, I suppose there's a risk there of escalation. That would probably be the argument that you got from some diplomats. But it does mean that we aren't playing with the same deck of cards, as it were. And if we're not willing to take any other actions either, it really does leave us with very few options.
True, Kim. Look, we at the Journal are going to keep Evan's name in the news and in the public mind as often as we can. We are doing our best to try to make sure that he is taken care of to the extent you can in prison, that he's treated well. And we are doing everything we can, pulling whatever levers we can to try to get him out. And we will continue to do that. He is in our thoughts. And we hope he will be in the thoughts of our listeners as well. Thank you all for joining us on Potomac Watch. We're here every day, and thanks for listening.